This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening and welcome. Can you all hear me back there in the cheap seats? All right. Well, welcome to the Lannan Foundation in Pursuit of Cultural Freedom series featuring Chris Williams. I'm David Barsamian. That wasn't an applause line. And this is the next to the last program in this remarkable series that the Lannan Foundation has been sponsoring. The final event will be on April 10th with Phyllis Bennis talking about the Middle East. Just a word about this evening's format. I'll have a brief introduction that will be followed by Chris Williams' lecture, and then he and I, after a five-minute break, will have a discussion on stage. There's more than tear gas and pepper spray in the air. The economic crash has opened fissures. The bromides and nostrums of old do not suffice. Serious questions are being asked. In Wisconsin, in the dead of winter, a million signatures were gathered to recall Governor Scott Walker and other officials. 1,000 people were arrested in one of the biggest civil disobedience actions in years at the White House, opposing the Keystone XL pipeline. The Obama administration has put the project on hold only. There'll be more on this from our speaker later. In New Mexico, a major multi-billion dollar expansion at Los Alamos, strenuously opposed by Los Alamos study groups and other citizen activists, has been shelved, supposedly because of budgetary constraints, but clearly the heat in the streets is making an impact on policymakers in Washington. More on that as well from our speaker. In Iraq, the U.S. empire has been effectively forced out. In Afghanistan, aptly named Graveyard of Empires, the last tango in Kandahar is on full and ignominious display. In Chicago, in the face of promised mass demonstrations, the Obama administration has moved the G8 summit to Camp David, also called a retreat. Last but not least, the Occupy Wall Street movement, celebrating 6 months on St. Patrick's Day. It has given energy to the idea of another world is possible. It is injecting into the popular imagination and discourse not just income inequality and income wealth inequality and class, but the very nature of the capitalist economic system. All this brings me, in a circuitous way, to the focus of this evening's event, entitled, "Are Global Warming and Ecological Degradation Caused by Free Market Enterprise?" As they say in my hometown, are you kidding me? The scientific evidence is extensive and unambiguous. The earth is heating up. Glaciers are melting. Water levels are rising. Capitalism, as Chris Williams says, is an economic system profoundly and irrevocably at odds with a sustainable planet. Given the enormity of the ecological crisis and what it portends, the lack of urgency in addressing it from ruling elites is rather astonishing. With a bow to T.S. Eliot, in the room the leaders come and go, talking of Enviro. Climate summits from Rio to Copenhagen to Cancun to the recent one in Durban produce nothing but hot air pumped into the atmosphere instead of meaningful and substantive action. We get cap-and-trade deals producing more pollution, and Earth Days and endless palaver about how green the corporations are and how much they care for the environment. Witness BP's full-court press right now on all the great work it is doing in the Gulf. There's been a massive advertising campaign burnishing its green credentials without any sense of irony or, I might add, shame. And, of course, our great media regale us with more Kardashian adventures, American Idol, and Peyton Manning. Bear with me this metaphor. Capitalism is Ahab, mad and rapacious. Moby Dick is nature. And the Pequod is humankind. Are we all to be bystanders as the ship goes down? There is still time to change direction. 50 years ago, Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. Chris Williams' Ecology and Socialism, in my view, is no less an important book. I urge you to get it. In it, he says, it is no exaggeration to state that without swift, dramatic, and profound changes to societal priorities, including a fundamental reorientation away from fossil fuel-based energy and profit-driven capitalistic economic growth, the generation growing up today, and there are a lot of young people in the audience, and welcome, thank you for being here. The generation growing up today will be, in all likelihood, the last to know climate stability. Please give a warm welcome to Chris Williams. Good luck.
Thanks very much. Great to see so many young people in the audience. Fantastic. Good evening. First, let me thank the Lannan Foundation for their generous support of my work and the opportunity to speak to you in this marvelous venue. Many thanks also to all of you for coming. My thanks to David Barsamian for that wonderful introduction. I actually carried out research into solar energy for my first master's in energy systems and environmental management at UNM. So I'm happy, particularly happy to be back here, spending a few days in the resounding splendor and majesty of the Southwest. So tonight, what I want to do is unmask and hold up to the light the root cause of our ecological crisis and pose a series of questions and suggest some answers. First, why is it so important that we identify the primary cause? It's imperative that we identify the root cause of our metabolic rift with nature, to use Marx's phrase, because if we misattribute the cause, we will misidentify the solution. We will believe we're solving the problem when, in fact, we're not even addressing it. We will believe we are coming to the table with some great, great proposals when, in reality, we're not even sitting at the right table. In contrast to many other explanations for the dire ecological situation we find ourselves in, such as population growth, consumerism, or more merely poor energy choices, I contend that it is the system of free market enterprise, otherwise known as capitalism, that is at the root of our ecological crisis. Indeed, there is a clue in the words themselves that not all may be as it seems with the system of free market enterprise, as it is a system where nothing is in fact free. If it is capitalism that is following Aristotle, the efficient cause of the crisis, then the solution swims into our vision through the murk of carbon trading, techno fixes, or lifestyle changes with great clarity and simplicity. We need to change the system. This immediately begs the next question: how? And if we want to get rid of capitalism, which I would argue is the only rational course of action, if we want to bequeath a planet to our children that looks remotely like the one onto which we were born, then what economic, political, and social system would we replace it with that is ecologically sustainable? What, if any, writers or models can we look towards for some guidance? Now, giving a definitive answer to each of those questions, the cause of the global ecological crisis, the way out, and the answer, i.e. solving all of the world's problems, may be a bit much for a 45-minute talk. However, we'll see how it goes, and at the very least, by the time we get to the end, you should have some food for thought. So I'm going to begin with a debate in the scientific community. This is not the debate over climate change or whether it's caused by human activities. That debate closed some time ago. The debate I want to touch on is whether we have entered a new geological epoch. As the last ice age ended around 12,000 years ago, there was a radical change in global climate, plant, and animal life, and geologists felt able to designate a new epoch called the Holocene, from the Greek meaning entirely recent. This relatively benign and stable climatic period coincided with the rise of human civilization that saw humans for the first time living in towns. We were able to shift from small nomadic bands of hunter-gatherers to permanent fixed communities and agriculture. Geologists are now debating whether humanity, by our activities, has changed the living and non-living environment that it justifies the designation of a new epoch, the Anthropocene, which translates as the Age of Man. Unfortunately, there are many arguments in favor of this change. To mention only a few, 80% of the Earth's land surface has been modified by humans, with about 40% now being used for agriculture. There are now more trees existing as farmed monoculture plantations than there are in natural forests. Deforestation is continuing at a rate of 80,000 square kilometers a year. More than 90% of the total biological mass of mammals in the world is either human or the animals that we have domesticated. The oceans are more acidic than they have been in the last 800,000 years, and new data indicates the rate of change is faster than anything seen in the last 300 million years. Now, on the off chance I'm not depressing you enough, we're wiping out species faster than we can discover and classify them at about 100 to 1,000 times the geological statistical norm, leading to what some are calling the sixth great extinction. By the vast and unprecedented burning of ancient sunlight, i.e. fossil fuels low in radioactive carbon, we're changing not just the amount of carbon, but also the isotopic ratio of carbon in the atmosphere. Through various scientific techniques, all of these changes would show up clearly in the geological record of the future. So a growing number of geologists are coalescing around a positive answer to the Anthropocene debate. So the next question arises, when would we say that the age of man began? And the most compelling answer to that, that would be easily measurable over extremely long periods of time, and which was a global and highly distinguishable phenomenon, brings me here to New Mexico on July 16th, 1945, the year of the first nuclear test at Alamogordo. Suddenly and irrevocably, man, and we are talking about men here, changed the isotopic composition of the Earth's atmosphere. In other words, a more radioactive atmosphere may be the easiest and most obvious way to spot the legacy of humanity. In a way, the crowning achievement of our technological prowess. Is it possible to use nuclear weapons and their offshoot, nuclear power, as a metaphor for the anti-ecological, never-ending expansionism and short-term time horizon of capitalism? Without realizing it, our very language has certainly been shaped by the atomic age. Words are important, and like radon gas seeping unseen into underground mines, the phrases of nuclear power, nuclear physics, have slipped quietly into our culture and everyday vernacular. Think about when you last heard or used these words: critical mass, meltdown, ground zero, chain reaction, fallout. To quote from the 1946 report on the international control of atomic energy by the U.S. State Department, a report drafted in part by Robert Oppenheimer, quote, "The development of atomic energy for peaceful purposes and the development of atomic energy for bombs are in much of their course interchangeable and interdependent." While this connection is so often denied by government and corporate apologists for nuclear power, how else are we to explain the ratcheting up of war fever against Iran for its civil nuclear program, which it's perfectly entitled to pursue under international law, and done so by the only state to have developed and actually used nuclear weapons? In yet more bad news, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, a group formed out of the disillusionment and horror at the birth of the atomic age, which they had helped usher onto the world historical stage, this year moved the doomsday clock 2 minutes closer to midnight, based on two factors. One, the continued proliferation of nuclear weapons, and secondly, the fact that virtually no concerted action is being taken to avert catastrophic climate change. Now, there's a small book that is mentioned as influential by one of the leading physicists who worked on the Manhattan Project, Leo Szilard, by H.G. Wells, The World Set Free, A Study of Mankind. Now, this book is as remarkable as a piece of art, and as a prophetic parable for our times. It's simultaneously a pen to the power of atomic energy, as well as warning about its dangers and connection to atomic weapons. Perhaps what's most remarkable is the prescience with which Wells, who's writing in 1914, prior to World War I, and only just after the discovery of the nucleus, he writes about the future of the 20th century, after man has harnessed the almost immeasurable power of atomic energy. And I'd like to quote from him. "This spectacle of feverish enterprise was productivity, this crowding flight of happy and fortunate rich people. Every great city was as if a crawling anthill had suddenly taken wing. This was the bright side of the opening phase of the new epoch in human history. Beneath that brightness was a gathering darkness, a deepening dismay. If there was a vast development of production, there was also a huge destruction of values. These glaring factories working night and day, these glittering new vehicles swinging noiselessly along the roads, these flights of dragonflies that swooped and soared and circled in the air, were indeed no more than the brightnesses of lamps and fires that gleam out when the world sinks towards the twilight and the night. Between these highlights, accumulated disaster, social catastrophe. There is an extreme disjunction between the technology that we have manufactured and the uses to which it is put, a disjunction that we can lay at the feet of capitalism, a social system which knows no other purpose than the accumulation of money. This dynamic was captured by the late Donald Trautlein, former CEO of Bethlehem Steel, when he commented, "I am not in the business of making steel. I am in the business of making money." More recently, audience members may have read the high-profile resignation letter of Greg Smith, who, until March 14th of this year, was an executive director at Goldman Sachs. On the New York Times op-ed page, he stated, quote, I attend derivative sales meetings where not one single minute is spent asking questions about how we can help clients. It's purely about how we can make the most possible money off them. It makes me ill how callously people talk about ripping their clients off." Now, given the kind of angry, pitchfork-toting climate that quite rightly exists against the bankers and the financial industry after they brought the world economy to its knees in 2008 and then got bailed out for their troubles by the government, one might think there might be a somewhat contrite response to this rather embarrassing revelation from one of their own. Not a bit of it. An editorial appeared on the financial site Bloomberg.com later that day. Quote, "We have some advice for Smith, as well as the thousands of college students who apply to work at Goldman Sachs each year. If you want to dedicate your life to serving humanity, do not go to work for Goldman Sachs. That's not its function, and it never will be. Go to work for Goldman Sachs if you wish to work hard and get paid more than you deserve." Yes, humility is not one of their strong points. Indeed, Lloyd Blankfein, CEO of Goldman Sachs, believes bankers in general, and his company in particular, are on a righteous messianic crusade. In a 2009 interview with the Times of London, he made his infamous claim to be a direct emissary from God. Quote, "We have a social purpose. We are doing God's work." Marx captured a similarly relentless and callous dynamic when he wrote of the dichotomy between machinery, humanity, and the natural world under capitalism that contains within it one of the most problematic and contradictory facets of the system, its inherent short-termism. Quote, "In its blind, unrestrainable passion, its werewolf hunger for surplus value, capital oversteps not only the moral, but even the merely physical maximum bounds of the working day. It usurps the time for growth, development, and healthy maintenance of the body. It steals the time required for the consumption of fresh air and sunlight. It higgles over a mealtime, incorporating it where possible with the process of production itself, so that food is supplied to the laborer as to a mere means of production, as coal is supplied to the boiler, grease and oil to the machinery. It reduces the sound sleep needed for the restoration, reparation, refreshment of the bodily powers to just so many hours of torpor as the revival of an organism, absolutely exhausted, renders essential. It is not the normal maintenance of a healthy human being which is to determine the limits of the working day. It is the greatest possible expenditure of one's labor power, no matter how diseased, compulsory, and painful it may be. Marx was a great writer. He goes on, capital cares nothing for the length of labor power. All that concerns it is simply and solely the maximum of labor power that can be rendered fluent in a working day. It attains this by shortening the extent of the worker's life, as a greedy farmer snatches increased produce from the soil by robbing it of its fertility. Now, no doubt, all of us can relate to having to eat fast food while on the run, working longer than we wish, often in utterly pointless activities, fall asleep exhausted, wake before we're fully rested, live in unhealthy conditions without the time or resources to live anywhere else or in any other way. But with his reference to the greedy farmer increasing production to rob the soil of its fertility, Marx's passage suggests that the exploitation of the social world is simply the mirror image for the exploitation of the natural world. Hence, if we are to overcome the challenge of our age and avert the incipient ecological crisis, we have to simultaneously operate and work toward a social and an ecological revolution. We must be equally social justice activists as much as we are ecological justice activists. The success of one is predicated, I would argue, upon the success of the other. Now, in this part of the world, perhaps nothing demonstrates this argument than those who are exploited in order to obtain the raw materials for the nuclear project in the first place, unwittingly dying disproportionately from a host of malignant diseases, and who continue to die because their land, now robbed twice over, remains lethally contaminated. The Navajo, who are promised wealth and a chance to serve their country in return for their labor in the uranium mines of their reservation, were also told by their so-called guardian in D.C. that their land would be returned to them in the state in which it was found. The hundreds of abandoned uranium mines, mounds of contaminated tailings, and radioactive pools that litter the landscape of their ancestral home tell another story, one of decades of broken promises, racism, and economic exploitation in the service of enormous corporate profit and the U.S. government's nuclear weapons stockpile. The Department of Defense knew all about the negative health effects of radiation from the late 40s and indeed sought to carry out health studies in order to find out more. The DOD Program Guidance Report of 1952 by the Joint Panel on the Medical Aspects of Atomic Warfare states, quote, advantage should be taken of any opportunities for the study of the biological effects of radiation, particularly in man. Of course, Navajos were never told about the risks they were running from uranium mining. If they had been, it seems unlikely that they would have taken to building their houses from uranium-laced mining waste, or perhaps not even given permission to sink the mines in the first place. The cancer rate among Navajos doubled between the 1970s and the 1990s, and as people probably here know better than I, legal cases against the mining companies and the U.S. government to admit culpability and effectively clean up all of the contaminated land and water continue to this day, 70 years later. That cleanup is likely to continue for another several decades. The EPA, by its own admission, has no end time or end date. They began working on the reservation's largest mine at Northeast Church Rock in 2005 and don't expect to be finished until 2019. When even some committed environmentalists talk of nuclear power as the clean alternative to fossil fuels and the answer to climate change, the long-term ravaging of once healthy communities and ongoing cleanup gives us a primary lesson in the toxic inheritance conferred by nuclear operations, not to mention the priorities of a system based on profit. As climate change takes hold and unusual weather patterns become the norm, ironically, Los Alamos, the birthplace of atomic weapons, was itself threatened last summer by the largest fire in New Mexico state history, the last conscious fire that started on June 26th and burnt through 150,000 acres in northern New Mexico. The fire forced the evacuation of the lab and raises yet more questions about the spread of radiological waste by wind from the fire-devastated areas. Fortunately, as David mentioned, New Mexico and local anti-nuclear activists did obtain some good news recently as the Department of Energy announced they're deferring construction of the chemistry metallurgy research replacement facility and plutonium reprocessing operation at the Los Alamos National Labs. Now, while there were the predictable howls of protest about jobs going elsewhere, New Mexico is another area of the world to suffer the so-called resource curse of capitalist exploitation, New Mexico is one of the poorest states in the country, despite receiving a disproportionate amount of federal aid, lavished almost exclusively on Los Alamos and Sandia. Furthermore, not only is New Mexico one of the poorest in absolute terms, it also suffers one of the states with the greatest disparity between rich and poor. It's one of the poorest, most unequal states inside one of the most unequal countries. I just returned from an area of the world which has been on the receiving end of the weapons developed here and is once again the scene of a nuclear catastrophe. Almost 1 year ago to the day, the people of Fukushima Prefecture in Japan, already reeling from a gigantic earthquake and the ensuing tsunami that killed as many as 15,000 people, found they had to simultaneously contend with three exploding and melting down nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power complex. Now, we now know, such was the chaos after the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear explosions, that contrary to the initial reports that things were bad but basically under control, at one point TEPCO, the utility, the corporation that runs the plants, sent a report to the Japanese government arguing that Tokyo, a city of 35 million people, might have to be evacuated. The safety systems and emergency centers that were in place were either knocked out, unstaffed, not provisioned, or not designed to be inside a high radiation zone, even though that was their express purpose. Many of the safety precautions that could have been mandated were instead voluntary. Hence, as a corporation focused on profit maximization, TEPCO took the logical decision not to implement them. If this all sounds too familiar to BP's lack of concern for health, safety, or the environment in the wake of the Gulf Oil Spill of 2010, or Massey Energy's coal mine disaster in West Virginia of the same year, and you perhaps begin to discern a pattern, it's because ultimately the dictates of bottom-line capitalism trump all other considerations. Only through the bravery of the nuclear workers who stayed at the stricken plant when TEPCO officials were saying it needed to be abandoned was this much larger calamity averted. As bad as the situation is now, it's not possible to imagine what things would have been like if Daiichi had been abandoned, which would have forced the abandonment of the reactors at Daini, which is very nearby, about 7 miles away, and quite possibly Tokai, forcing the evacuation of up to 100 million Japanese. Just think about that for a second. In Fukushima, I spoke with many people who all said the same thing. They are now living in a state of constant fear and anxiety as they campaign for better information, more evacuations, and better compensation, because the government has been exposed as clearly not being transparent, has been found to be far too cozy with the corporations, wonder where we've heard that before, and has constantly been minimizing or not testing properly for radiation. So people have been forced, essentially, to become amateur radiologists. In order to minimize the number of evacuees, and there are still 110,000 of them, the Japanese government arbitrarily raised the internationally accepted dose 20 times, from 1 millisievert per year to 20. So this new safe limit makes no distinction between the effects of radiation on adults versus children, who are still growing, obviously, nor pregnant mothers, nor between radiation exposure inside the body versus outside. In another sign of the importance of words, some evacuees are no longer referring to themselves as evacuees, because the word evacuee implies that you'll go back. They're now talking of themselves as members of the Fukushima diaspora because they now think they'll never be able to return. A group of women from Kuriyama City showed me the government form they have to fill out for their children, noting down where their child has been for the day and what they ate, along with the radiation monitors that the children have to carry around with them. As one of the mothers who would only give her name as Nihon Matsu, the town where she is from, for fear of reprisals, quite reasonably asked me, well, if it's so safe here, why is the government giving us these? Imagine the kind of social, domestic, and economic pressures the people are living under as they debate whether they should stay because of their jobs or leave because of their health. I spoke with Hatsumi Terashima, a fisherman from Minamisoma, for the last 54 years. He showed me the 2 to 3 feet of foundations that poked up from the mud that are all that remain of his house. He was caught in the tsunami and dragged 3 kilometers inland, but unlike 5 of his family members, he managed to survive. He can't fish anymore, not just because he doesn't have a boat, a house, or a crew, but because of fears of radioactive contamination of the fish off the coast. So even if he could go out and fish, there's no guarantee he could sell them, once they were labeled as coming from Fukushima. I met one inspiring person after another that are organizing and protesting. A young female DJ from Fukushima City called Chika Shishido ran to the local radio station after the earthquake, and with one other DJ, they broadcast 24/7 for 10 days straight to get the word out about the state of infrastructure, emergency services, and radioactive contamination. One of the striking things that I noticed about the new movement against nuclear power in Japan is that it's mostly led by women who are not just challenging the nuclear power structure, but also raising questions of gender equality. She was keen to tell me why that was so important to her and the movement itself. Quote, "It's not a mother and child thing. It's about women's rights. People think that because we are concerned with the evacuation of women and children, it makes it seem like it's a traditional issue, that women need to be protected. We need to make this clear if we want change, that this is not why we are leading this fight. It's fundamentally about the right to life. Now, she'd like to have a baby, but she's scared of the consequences, and so she's quit her job and is moving to Hokkaido in the north to try and find work and peace of mind. I was taken to a mall in Kuriyama City, where in amongst the shops, there's now a volunteer-run radiation testing center. They're testing food, and they also have a full body scanner. Anyone under the age of 20 can go and get tested for free. Imagine going to a mall down the street and seeing the Citizens Radiation Testing Center. Or imagine walking into your apartment building to be met with a large chart listing weekly radiation readings from different areas in and around your building, with particularly high values circled in red. This is now the daily reality for people in Fukushima City. I met the famous Japanese film actor Taro Yamamoto. So he's suddenly been without job offers since becoming an anti-nuclear activist. I asked him, you know, given some of the hardships that have been placed on you, why are you doing all this? And he said, because I want to live. People's human rights are being violated in Fukushima. And if they can do it to people here, eventually they'll do it to me. And I don't want to see Japan end. But this is not just about Japan. This is the whole world. And then later on, completely by accident, I bumped into him at a Tokyo train station. He was up on a soapbox with a megaphone, exhorting people to sign a petition to demand a referendum on nuclear power. And they started 3 months before I got there, and they'd already collected an incredible 3 million signatures. But in parallel with the way the Navajo were treated as expendable labor here, so too we find in Japan that 80% of nuclear workers are subcontracted day laborers without employment rights, a pension, or health plan. So even in such an inherently unsafe and dangerous industry as nuclear power, we still find corporations cutting corners to maximize profit. I had the honor of meeting one of the workers from Fukushima Daiichi, Kitajima-san, when he was in New York City at a panel that I moderated on the anniversary of the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster. And he spoke of the day laborer situation. Quote, they're paid day laborers, and they're cornered financially. They have no other choices. Those workers expect they will suffer from radiation poison or diseases caused by radiation in 5 years. But they have already given up hope of medical benefits or compensation from the federal government. It makes me angry to think of a system created to force these people to face this kind of danger, which he also faces. Sometimes I go through 6 changes of radiation protective clothing a day. They're not recycled. They're just thrown away. The clothes are disposable, and so are the people. One has to wonder who took the decision for Japan, a small geologically active island prone to earthquakes and tsunamis, known as the land of volcanoes, to become so dependent upon nuclear power, and in whose interests was that decision taken? Every single one of the 54 reactors in Japan is built along the coast. At the moment, only 2 of those 54 are operational, and yet there are no blackouts. And this is leading many Japanese to ask more questions, like, why did we build them in the first place? And why don't we have a renewable energy sector worth mentioning, despite the fact that we were once world leaders in solar technology? As Kazuo Suzuki of Greenpeace Japan has pointed out, quote, this disaster was predictable and predicted, but happened because of the age-old story of cutting corners to protect profits over people. The authorities are already recklessly pushing to restart reactors without learning anything from the Fukushima disaster, and the people will once again be forced to pay the price of their government's mistakes. Now, of course, we all know back here about not getting renewable energy too. Which U.S. president, this is a quiz for you, said the following, quote, "Over the last 3 years, we've opened millions of new acres for oil and gas exploration. And tonight, I'm directing my administration to open more than 75% of our potential oil and gas resources." If you guessed the oil and gas misadministration of George W. Bush, you'd be wrong. That was President Obama in his most recent State of the Union address. And in case we were in any doubt about where his administration stands on the XL tar sands pipeline that David mentioned, that we managed to get a temporary halt in by the massive demonstrations and the arrest of over 1,000 protesters, White House spokesman Jay Carney handily clarified, quote, "We support the company's interest in proceeding with this project. We look forward to working with TransCanada, and we commit to taking every step possible to expedite the necessary federal permits." The majority of this year's budget request of $27.2 billion by the rather Orwellian-named Department of Energy is for, in fact, nuclear weapons. While the Los Alamos project for processing plutonium was cut, there's still $7.6 billion for what is being called safe, secure stockpile of nuclear weaponry, $2.5 billion for non-proliferation efforts, $5.7 billion to continue cleaning up the effects of nuclear weapons manufacture that I mentioned earlier. Nuclear energy gets a further $770 million, despite numerous reports documenting just how uneconomic it is. To mention one, Citibank, an institution that has rarely met a risky investment that it could say no to, issued a report in 2009 on nuclear energy under the headline, "Nuclear Power, the Economics Say No." More recently, The Economist ran an article, "Nuclear Power, the Dream That Failed." In contrast, the requested amount for solar energy was a mere $310 million. Meanwhile, back at the Pentagon, they're gearing up to embrace renewable technology. In a front-page New York Times article of 2010, the paper reported that, quote, "Even as Congress has struggled to unsuccessfully pass an energy bill, and many states have put renewable energy on hold because of the recession, the military this year has pushed rapidly forward. After a decade of waging wars in remote corners of the globe where fuel is not readily available, senior commanders have come to see overdependence on fossil fuels as a big liability. And renewable technologies, which have become more reliable and less expensive over the past few years, as providing a potential answer." So it appears that the U.S. military, which is the world's single largest polluter, can have renewable energy to go and fight wars overseas. Paradoxically, to fight wars to secure access to yet more fossil fuels. But we can't have renewable energy here at home. To quote Martin Luther King from his historic 1967 speech at Riverside Church, where he first publicly came out against the war in Vietnam, "A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death." To that, I think we can only add that we are now approaching ecological death. But if we don't want nuclear and we don't want fossil fuels, what are the alternatives that the Pentagon sees as so beneficial and useful? And if they exist, why aren't they being implemented right here? To give you a few ideas about that, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change last year released a special report on renewable energy sources, illustrating how it would be possible, in their words, given a change in political priorities, to generate 80% of world energy from a mix of six renewable sources by 2050. That's 80%. While I take issue with some of those sources, such as biofuels, the report is significant in that it has to be reached by consensus. All of the participating governments have to sign off on it. So it can therefore be taken as eminently possible. Other more radical but still comprehensive reports have been released by PricewaterhouseCoopers, Greenpeace, the European Climate Foundation, World Wildlife Fund, and the Institute for Policy Research and Development, all indicating how 100% carbon-free generation of electricity is entirely possible within 40 years. Now, whatever skepticism people may have, carefully and expensively, cultivated by the fossil fuel and nuclear lobbies, they can't all be wrong. A study reported in Scientific American showed how it would be possible to have 100% of world energy provided from renewable sources by 2030. It would require manufacturing 3.8 million large wind turbines, 90,000 solar arrays, alongside numerous geothermal, tidal, and rooftop photovoltaic installations. The cost estimate was significantly less than if the same power was generated from fossil fuels and nuclear. Now, the construction of 3.8 million wind turbines sounds like a lot, but when you over a 20-year period. But when you stack that up against the 70 million cars that are manufactured every single year around the world, then it's in fact quite feasible. To give you another frame of reference, there are 101,000 terawatts of solar power falling on the Earth from the sun. Current global energy use is 15. So we would only have to capture a small fraction of 1% of this energy to power the whole planet. Now, I'm not saying that that's what we would do. We would need a plan. But it gives you a sense of what's possible. Furthermore, the scope for reducing energy consumption through the enactment of energy efficiency regulations for appliances and retrofitting housing, commercial and industrial stock for energy efficiency is enormous, not to mention a massive public transit program so that we can move away from the enormous inefficiency, pollution, and waste associated with reliance on private automobiles. There are currently millions of Americans without jobs or in part-time jobs that would relish the opportunity to rebuild the infrastructure of tomorrow along sustainable and energy-efficient lines. But the priorities of capitalism dictate that they may remain rotting on unemployment lines and the millions of jobs that need doing to rebuild our collapsing bridges, build the new train lines, energy grids, and the energy-efficient buildings and infrastructure that are so urgently needed don't get carried out. We're not offered those kind of jobs. The only jobs we get offered are those that force us into a Faustian trade-off between jobs and the environment, the kind that just happened to coincide with corporate priorities such as building the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. Then there's the production of useless things, inbuilt obsolescence, marketing, advertising, the military, alongside the gargantuan waste generated by the daily operation of capitalism. One half to three quarters of resource inputs to industry are returned to the environment as waste within a year. Capitalism is only efficient at one thing: the generation of money. The generation of waste is not a sign of the failure of capitalism, but conversely, a sign of its success. The more waste is generated, the faster things are wearing out, and the more things can be sold to replace them. The problem is therefore not technical at all, but entirely social and political, and revolves around the question of social power. Who has it and who doesn't? Who makes the decisions in society, and in whose interests are they made? What Occupy Wall Street has exposed is the reality we've all been living with. The answer to both those questions is the 1%, the tiny number of the ruling elite in each country who run the system in the interests of the gigantic multinational corporations that dominate the economic and political landscape and are busily trashing the natural landscape in their relentless and insatiable pursuit of profit. Capitalism is a system that is driven by the need to make money in order to stay afloat. That, in turn, drives the constant expansion of the system. Marx explains it very simply in just three letters: M, C, M prime. The capitalist starts with money, M. He turns it into a commodity, C. He then sells it for more money, M prime, and the system starts again. But now it is a system that has more money to invest, and so it's constantly enlarging itself. As we live on a finite planet, there is a clear logical contradiction, and we're now finding out what the limits of the planet are to tolerate this form of unending and destructive growth. Furthermore, there's no possibility to consider the longer-term effects of whatever it is that was just made, because every company is in cutthroat competition with every other company, and there's certainly no incentive to take care of either the worker or the natural resource base except when forced to by social regulation. And of course, they're busily, constantly trying to undermine that. In the Financial Times today, there was an article about this Dallas billionaire who's flooding, he made his money on nuclear waste, by the way, floods super PACs with funds. It goes on to quote, some wealthy Americans, however, defend the super PACs and say the rich wield too little clout in national politics. Quote, "I think the wealthy have an insufficient influence," Ken Griffin, hedge fund billionaire, told the Chicago Tribune earlier this month, adding that, quote, "those who have enjoyed the benefits of our system had a duty to protect it." Absolutely no shame whatsoever. So we do need to fight for more government regulation to limit feckless corporations from evading all constraints on health, safety, and the environment. But we also need a much broader and more extensive vision for change. We all currently live in a world dominated by a single system of production that's built around competition and production for profit, predicated on a lack of real democracy. That is the system that has brought us to the edge of the ecological precipice. I want to live in a world defined by cooperation and production for need based on real economic and political democracy, where the goal is not more money, but social equality and natural harmony. Such a system is socialism, where the machines control workers, as under capitalism, or workers control machines, as under socialism, is a critically important point as it relates to sustainability, because the tools and machinery we use are extensions of our physical and mental abilities to manipulate, control, and investigate nature. These tools are the product of tens of thousands of years of human development and are what allow us to understand nature on deeper and deeper levels, right down to the subatomic. The machinery is, or should be viewed as, the physical materialization of our brains and hands. It is nature's way of discovering and linking itself to itself because we're a part of nature. If machinery and technology was reconstructed on the basis of efficient use of resources, longevity, labor-saving potential, and minimization of waste products, then all of humanity could be freed, free to fulfill the full range of human interests and pursuits. These would include an exploration and understanding of our fundamental connection to the earth as material beings, rather than enslaved to the rhythm and relentless pace of emails, texts, the vacuous nature of 24-hour news cycles, empty advertising slogans, automated machines, agricultural machinery, production lines, time and motion studies, and every other facet of our alienated existence under capitalism. On this basis, as machines increase in efficiency, take over human functions, and save human labor for more creative activities, they'll transform humanity's former relation of life and death struggle against nature into a new relation, one of free time, of leisure, cultural pursuits, and the opportunity for the fulfillment of distinctively human needs. For the first time in human history, we can begin to relate to external non-human nature in non-competitive ways, ways that are not simply seen as a utilitarian need. What can we get from nature? How can we use it? What is it good for? How can we subdue and dominate it? Rather, we will have the time to stand back in awe and fully appreciate the natural world purely for the sake of its existence and the psychological, spiritual, and material sense of uplift it gives us to know that we're alive in its midst. The serene beauty of the stars, the magnificence of a sunset, the intricate evolutionary delicacy of a bird's wing match so perfectly to its function. Under an alternative ecologically sustainable and socially just system, no product would be made without it meeting the highest standards of use value. The questions will not be, as they are under capitalism, how quickly can it be made at the lowest possible cost? How quickly can we get it to wear out before someone has to buy a new one? But instead, a whole set of new questions will be asked. What need does it serve? How little energy can it be made with? Are the materials adapted to its purpose? How can it be made to last as long as possible? How much waste is produced in its manufacture, and how best can we deal with this? Humanity interacts with its environment while simultaneously the environment acts back on us. In the process, both are changed. The environment is no longer, in that concept, an object, a passive object, to be plundered, or in the words of Marx's lifelong collaborator Friedrich Engels, made an object of huckstering, but would play a role in making us what we are. In this view, it's impossible to speak of any living thing, humans and their activity included, as anything but deeply enmeshed within each other in a constant state of mutual interaction, transformation, and co-evolution. This is why I avoid the word environment, because it posits that there are humans and then outside of us is the environment, as if we're somehow set apart from the natural world around us. Rather, we ought to use the word ecology and see humans as just as much a part of nature as anything else. We'd be able to begin to fulfill our spiritual needs, cultivating non-utilitarian knowledge of the universe for beauty, play, recreation, and for the observation of plants and animals and the inorganic world in all its diverse and wondrous forms. To paraphrase the ecological and leftist thinker Barry Commoner, nature is a self-enclosed system of energy exchanges. Nothing is isolated, nothing totally disappears, and nothing is free. Nature and society cannot be seen as diametrically opposed, but should co-evolve with one another as human naturalism and natural humanism become different aspects of the same thing. For Marx, it was necessary to heal the metabolic rift created between humanity and nature by capitalism. Quote, from the standpoint of a higher socio-economic formation, the private property of particular individuals in the earth will appear just as absurd as the private property of one man in other men. Even an entire society, a nation, or all simultaneously existing societies taken together are not owners of the earth. They are simply its possessors, its beneficiaries, and have to bequeath it in an improved state to succeeding generations, a concept that is totally alien to capitalism. If you think talking in such terms is a utopian dream, I would answer that it is far more utopian to believe that we can reform capitalism towards sustainability. And there are two decades of failed international climate negotiations as empirical evidence. You know things are getting bad and desperate when such a normally conservative group of people, such as scientists, are getting political. The March 16th issue of the leading U.S. scientific journal Science carries an article titled, quote, Navigating the Anthropocene, Improving Earth System Governance, where they argue, quote, science assessments indicate that human activities are moving several of Earth's subsystems outside the range of natural variability typical for the previous 500,000 years. They conclude that we have reached, quote, a constitutional moment in world politics. While they recognize a significant international political rearrangement as necessary, we need to go further and indict the entire system. Rather than have as humanity's legacy the irradiation of the atmosphere, catastrophic climate change, and planetary ecocide, as implied by the term Anthropocene, with which I began this talk, rather we should seek to enter an age where we finally begin to understand what it means to be fully human, because we really have no idea what that means currently. Connected to each other on the land, not as commodities to be bought and sold in the callous cash nexus of capitalism, but as a global community of cooperating humans working together toward a long-term future of equality, sustainability, and co-evolution with nature in all its living and non-living forms. Capitalism itself was born through revolution, as the rising bourgeoisie overthrew the previous feudal aristocratic ruling class in revolutionary upheavals such as 1776 and 1789 in order to impose the rule of the merchants and manufacturers that we have today. What was born through revolution can be ended by revolution. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
A stunning presentation.
Thank you.
Now, among the things that you talked about was the inherent nature of capitalism and its drive for profits, privileging profits over people rather than people over profits. What would you suggest as an alternative? I mean, you mentioned socialism several times. What do you mean by socialism? And hasn't socialism been tried in the Soviet Union and other places and has shown to be a failure?
Well, I think it's been tried once, and it did fail ultimately. But capitalism has failed many times, and we keep trying that. So I think it's worth giving socialism another chance. And I haven't got time to go into all of the details, but the Soviet Union failed for very specific reasons. And I talk about some of the earliest time period of the Soviet Union in the 1920s, which had a very different attitude towards ecology. It was one of the first places that you could take a degree in ecology in 1924. There were huge areas of the Soviet Union set aside as ecological areas where you couldn't even do tourism or anything. It was purely for research to see how they could rejuvenate damaged areas of the land. And all that was reversed with the ultimate triumph of the bureaucracy represented by Stalin. So I think that failed for very specific reasons. But I don't equate socialism with kind of state control. I think if there's no democracy, if the people aren't making the economic and political decisions, then I don't see how you could call that socialism. So if you think about China or Cuba or any of these other countries that North Korea call themselves socialist, I wouldn't argue that they are. I think you've just got one giant corporation called the state that runs everything. So I think socialism is about real democracy of the people in communities and workplaces, production for need, not profit, based on cooperation rather than competition.
In your book, you talk about some of the attitudes toward nature, and you quote Francis Bacon, for example. And I think there is a theological aspect to this with people like Winthrop and his City on the Hill. And to achieve that city on the hill, it was necessary to exploit nature, which was given to us as bounty by God. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been given to humankind.
Yes, well, Senator Inhofe has a similar opinion to that.
The Oklahoma Republican.
Yes, where he doesn't believe that climate change is real because God has already told him that it's not true. I think that there was a radical change. If you look at the way in which the Earth was viewed, some of which, the language of which we still retain in terms of the veins of ore and so on, the Earth was seen as a living thing in feudal times and before that, because people were much more connected to the land. Capitalism, if it wants to make money, has to make machines. And that means it has to understand nature. And therefore, you get Bacon and others completely changing the conception that nature is now not something that we live with and on, but something that needs to be investigated and defiled in many ways. And generations before the emergence of capitalism, people would have seen that as a defilement that actually was celebrated in very, very overtly sexual language by Bacon in particular that I mentioned in the book. And I think that rather than that, as I mentioned in the talk earlier, rather than that conception of nature that we need to dominate and control it for our own ends, which are towards the profit motive, we need to see ourselves as co-evolving as something equal because... there's the OECD recently came out with a very shocking report. The Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, the major economies, came out and said that we may be heading towards a world that is 3 degrees to 6 degrees warmer than anything we've seen for hundreds of thousands, billions of years. And most scientists will tell you 2 degrees is the maximum that we should be going up to. So they lay all this out. By 2050, we're going to be 3 to 6 degrees higher, which would mean the sea levels would be 300 feet, heading towards 300 feet higher. And at the end of it, they just say, well, the effect on GDP will just be a 14% reduction. So there's going to be no ice caps. That's literally what they say. There's going to be no ice caps. There's going to be deserts across large areas of the world, but there's only going to be a 14% reduction in GDP worldwide. And so, in other words, we are totally, there's this idea from economists and apologists for the system that we are essentially independent of nature. We could survive without air or water or a planet, and you know things can roll along as they always have. And clearly, we need to change that radically and think about not just where we're going tomorrow but, and making money from that, but a much longer term, a future generational thing, which Marx talks about and I mentioned.
And the impact on the most vulnerable. A couple of years ago, I was in Nepal at a place called Kalapattar, which is near Everest, and the Nepali cabinet was meeting there to dramatize the fact that the glaciers are melting. At around the same time in the Maldives, the cabinet met underwater.
Right.
To have a meeting to demonstrate their concern about rising levels of the oceans, which will inundate and essentially wipe out the Maldives islands. So again, the vulnerability of people in the so-called developing world is acute. And I think a lot of us here may be insulated from that while we are busy driving fuel-efficient cars and recycling and doing the right thing, environmentally speaking.
Well, maybe, unless you go to Texas or the wildfires that were all over New Mexico last year, or the unprecedented floods through the Midwest. I think that on the one hand, we are certainly somewhat more insulated, but that doesn't mean to say, I mean, people are already in a desperate situation in many areas of the world and are feeling the effects already. There are already climate refugees. There are wars because of the instability that climate change is bringing about in various areas of the world. And if we think that we're a part of this is also about the idea that we can save nature by setting aside small little areas called national parks to protect it. And yet, how is that going to work if the climate is completely different? How are the animals that feed on other animals or plants, when those things are moving north or south or up mountains, or the birds be able to migrate and change? Clearly, the whole idea that we can save nature in certain individual locations goes out the window with climate change. And so we have to rethink the whole planet on a sustainable and rational manner, which means, you know, I would be depressed about all this stuff. I mean, frequently this is depressing. But if it was, we don't have the answers. We actually do have the answers. It's not a technical problem. It's much more about how do we take power from the people who currently have it and put it in our hands. Yeah. So that we can actually start implementing some of the answers that we know will work.
It was Eduardo Galeano who said, I think, we have to save pessimism for better times. Now, a little bit more about this gentleman named Marx, who's been, you know, he's been dead for 150 years, and his relevance today, what is it about his analysis that you find urgent and vital and applicable to the problems that society is facing today?
I mean, it's a great question. I think what's important about going back to Marx and Engels is not just the specific things that he talks about, because obviously we can't backdate our concerns to him, and climate change was not on his horizon. But one of the things that he and Engels were both most concerned with was depletion of the soil. So that what was going on in his period of time, they were very concerned in Britain that the fertility of the soil was dropping, and what would they do? They hadn't invented artificial fertilizer by then. So they were, they'd already raided the Napoleonic battlefields, digging up the corpses of people who died in their wars to take back as natural fertilizer for the fields of England. They had to go further away to go and start wars in South America over guano. There were the guano wars of the 1800s that Marx wrote about in order to get that fertilizer back to England. And so they were Marx and Engels, his collaborator, were very much involved with an ecological question, and he was a great admirer of Darwin. But beyond that, I would say what's most compelling right now is their analysis of not just capitalism, but the methodology which they used. Because so often we're taught in schools that history is not connected. They're all a series of disconnected events. It's one of the things that makes history boring. You think something caused the First World War and it wasn't connected to the Second World War. You learn about famous people. There's no relationship to what's going on now or your life. In contrast, what Marx and Engels did, their methodology of historical materialism, was saying that everything is interconnected and everything affects everything else. And that's a very deeply ecological viewpoint. Furthermore, when he talked about the metabolic rift, the word metabolism had only been recently invented, but it means an exchange of materials in and out of a single cell or an organism. What was revolutionary about the way he used it in the phrase metabolic rift is he applied it to the whole biosphere. And so that is an enormously powerful tool and way of thinking about energy in and energy out and waste far ahead of his time, and I think is useful today.
Given the extraordinary depth of the economic collapse with its attendant millions of homes being lost, millions of people thrown out of work, pensions lost, and et cetera, Do you see now a kind of Gramscian possibility for an opening for socialism? Do you think there's more space now to even talk about a word that has been viewed so pejoratively historically in the United States?
I think there's enormous potential. When Barack Obama was first running for election and he was being accused, started to get accused of being a socialist.
That's the change you can believe in, President?
Yes, that's right, yeah. the change that didn't come. But when he was running, he started being accused of being a socialist because the right wing thought that this would be a negative. And people were like, it became the number one word Googled because people were like, well, I like Obama. They're calling him a socialist. I don't like them. Maybe I'm a socialist too. Let me go find out about it. So there was definitely a sense. I think that is significant. I also think that the economic crisis of 2008, coinciding with the ecological crisis, is raising questions in young people's minds and others that maybe there's a connection between those two things. Maybe one caused the other. And so are open to the idea that there are new possibilities. And I'm sure you saw the Pew poll that said young people in particular were more disposed to socialism than they were to capitalism because they know what capitalism is like, and who wants that? So in this day and age, and so I think that that is something that has woken people up. I also think that there was a huge change last year with the revolutions in the Middle East, has just completely changed people's reference point for what is possible. We've had 30 years of defeats. It's been a terrible time since Reagan and Thatcher and the birth of neoliberalism. I grew up in the 1980s, terrible decade. Very bad fashion sense, pretty bad music too, unfortunately, with a few exceptions. Now things are very hopeful again. And I went to, and they said, you know, the Middle East, what's going to happen there? A bastion of reaction, nobody's interested in democracy, and then millions of people on the streets fighting for democracy. Fantastically inspiring. I went to Madison, Wisconsin as part of my union, and to see what was going on there last spring during the uprising and the occupation, and it was amazing. Another area of the world, the Midwest, where we're told people are conservative, they don't follow politics. People in the Midwest in there were learning Arabic so that they could write their signs in Arabic and show their solidarity with the people in Egypt and Tunisia. And it was amazing to be in a town so full of pro-union sentiment. And then, of course, more recently, something I've been very involved in, Occupy Wall Street. Phenomenal. Completely changed the narrative in this country. We haven't won any practical victories yet, but we've won an enormous ideological victory. We're not talking about the debt ceiling debate or any other nonsense. We're talking about the rich, the 1%, and the 99%, everybody else, and why we need to get rid of them so that we can run things. So that's fantastically exciting.
Indeed, the lexicon has changed. Now, you mentioned the Middle East, a focus first of British and French imperialism, and then their successor, the United States, ever since 1945, having to do with a certain product that is known to be there. Yes. Under its sands.
Yes.
I'm not quite sure what it is, but it might be a three-letter word.
God works in mysterious ways.
It's actually a four-letter word in practice, but it's three in actual spelling. The focal point, the focus of U.S. imperial policy dealing with energy issues and its relation to ecology.
I think it's an enormously overlooked piece of the puzzle. There are a lot of great writers who write stuff on environmental issues and ecological questions. And this question of imperialism is so often either overlooked entirely or barely given any kind of detailed analysis. And I think that's a real mistake, because part of the big reason why the international negotiations go nowhere is because not only is there competition between individual corporations for power and prestige and profit, but there's also similarly competition, economic, political, between countries. And so that competition then leads and sparks warfare, warfare is just as integral a part of capitalism as competition. And so if you're not talking about the economic and political competition that goes on between states and their desire to control resources and the geopolitical great game, as it used to be called, then you're not providing a full analysis for people. And that's one of the major reasons why they cannot get any kind of agreement on climate change. I mean, they have a hard time getting agreement on even things that they care about, like trade, right? But things that they don't care about, like climate change, that's not even part of their frame of reference, then they have even more problems with, because, well, if I regulate my economy more than you, then I suffer an economic disadvantage. You now can go places and do things and produce profits cheaper than I can, and I'm at an economic disadvantage. And so that kind of dynamic prevents them from coming up with a rational plan. I mean, they'd rather nuke each other over a disputed oil field than come up with an internationally coordinated plan to plant some trees.
What are your views on what is called sustainable capitalism?
Pretty low.
Why?
Paul Hawken, who's actually an advocate of this, said, it's a contradiction in terms. You cannot have, or actually he said it about green capitalism, sorry. You cannot have a sustainable capitalism because every year, every capitalist entity has to grow larger for the process that I mentioned earlier. There is this constant dynamic of growth that if they're not growing, then they die. I mean, we see the economy today. What's the conversation about? We need to go back to growth. We need every nation on the planet needs to have 2 or 3% growth. Otherwise, what happens? We fall into a tailspin of unemployment, layoffs, cuts to social spending, obviously not the military budget, but everything else. And so without that growth, the system starts falling apart. Capitalism is literally a system that is based on the maxim, grow or die. And so the idea that in any way that could be sustainable, or that they could somehow care about the resources that they put in or the waste that they go out, is an impossibility, I would argue. They don't even see resources as anything but a free lunch. I mean, they take something free from the atmosphere, from the environment, and then they put it back in as waste. They don't pay for that stuff.
So I infer from that then that you are perhaps skeptical of tinkering around the edges, cosmetic changes such as recycling.
You could put me in the skeptic camp, I think. I'm not against recycling, but I think it's important to recognize that that's the first thing that we're told to do. And there's a reason for that, because it takes it away from the product itself and says the product is okay, right? It's fine. The problem is with you as a consumer and an individual. You are the problem because you don't put it in the right receptacle. It evades the whole question of why was that thing made in the first place and why was it made of plastic? I mean, there's nothing wrong with plastic. Plastic is, for example, people often talk about plastic water bottles, which is $100 billion a year industry. Plastic is an amazing material. It lasts virtually forever. So why would you make disposable things out of plastic? It should be illegal. it should be illegal.
But these are panaceas that are being served up.
Right.
If you do these things, if you drive the right car, things will be hunky-dory.
Absolutely. I think the idea is very much ideological, that we feel good about recycling, that we take it away from the production and we focus on the consumption. And if we do that, then everything will be okay. However, if you look at waste, only 2.5% of all waste is domestic, i.e. what all of us produce. So even if we could magically get rid of all of that, that would still leave 97.5% of industrial and agricultural waste. It would be irrelevant, in other words, apart from the fact that plastic cannot be really effectively recycled in the first place, which is why even if you put it to be recycled, 95% of it never is. That would be the last thing that you should do, not the first thing. the first thing should be to look at the production process and then match things to their function. And then we can go from there and talk about, at the end, if we really can't do anything, if we can't reuse it again, or maybe we should never have made it in the first place, that's a radical idea, we should then think about how can we best recycle it. Just to say, you can expand that to any kind of argument about kind of this tinkering around the edges and the focus on, because, capitalism, every time it messes something up, it doesn't try and correct that problem. It just tries to sell you something else. So the food system has become so toxic now that they invented another subset of the food system called organic food, so that, what was wrong with the first stuff? What did you do to that to make it so bad that we have to go and pay more money, if we can afford it, to get to organic food? And you can replicate that on any number of levels. The food crises, the various food scandals, people may remember swine flu a couple of years ago, where they've concentrated the animals in such horrendous situations, totally unhealthy, that they're diseased, right? They're incubators for disease. So during that outbreak, what did they do? Did they think, we really need to regulate these corporations so that they treat these animals more humanely? No, they just said, I know, we'll sell them sanitary masks, and then that'll be fine. So they just are constantly figuring out new ways. So if we accept that paradigm, that there's something else that we should buy, then we've already fallen into their trap.
You talked about in your presentation about the Bush period, the oligarchy. It was easy to kind of explain what was going on. These were people with close ties to the oil and gas industry. Yet, as you point out, Obama has followed basically the same template and, in fact, has, I believe, expanded and increased drilling permits, has opened up the Arctic as well.
Right. I think it was very easy to blame George W. Bush. And in some ways, Obama has got away with more than Bush could have got away with in his wildest dreams. Certainly on civil liberties, I think you could say Obama has been worse than George W. Bush. And I think there's an argument to be made on ecological issues that the same is true. If you think about the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history in 2010, the Gulf oil spill, when Obama had supermajorities in both houses of Congress and a massive amount of public support at that time, he could have done anything. But he didn't. In fact, he let the cleanup to the criminal who carried it out in the first place, BP. And so this is clearly not about changing Democrats for Republicans. I also think it's important to remember all of the best environmental laws that we've got on the books, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, etc., came about under the presidency of a right-wing Republican egomaniac called Richard Nixon. Now, who'd already caused colossal environmental devastation, not to mention mass murder, in Southeast Asia. Why did he decide that now was the time I want to protect the water and the air? Because there was a massive movement on the streets that demanded it. And so that's really the answer. I don't think it's about the politicians. It's about what we do on the streets and how organized we get.
The gravity of the multiple ecological crises demand collective and global action, not one-off, one country doing this or Canada doing that. How to get there to collective action?
That's the all-important question, right? I think that we've had some examples. I mentioned the Middle East. Also recently, the massive protests in Germany against nuclear power completely changed another right-wing government, Angela Merkel, who's the premier and who's pro-nuclear. And yet now Germany has already shut 9 of their nuclear reactors, is shutting down the rest within 10 years, and has a plan in place to reduce their carbon emissions by 30% by 2020 and then by 80% by 2050. So that's not because they suddenly became a green government. It's because they were forced to become a green government. So I think those kind of things resonate around the world, and the same is true in Italy, in Switzerland, which are also shutting down their nuclear power stations, and hopefully Japan will be the next country. But I think it's also significant that the countries that are resisting the most in terms of that kind of change are also the countries that have nuclear weapons. So Germany, Switzerland, France, for example, and Japan do not have nuclear weapons.
France does.
Sorry, did I say France?
Yeah.
Sorry, I meant Italy, Switzerland, Germany, and Japan don't have nuclear weapons. And so the movements there have more latitude. I think it would be extremely difficult in this country for the government, ideologically, to justify keeping nuclear weapons, which they want, and then but abandoning nuclear power. So I think that the campaign here has to be much more powerful. How we get to that? I mean, I think it's the same as any other movement, right? I think Occupy Wall Street, we haven't been fighting for a long time, and finally we are. That's exciting. It's finally become a two-sided battle. And we need to catch up with our organization. And that is the next challenge as we move forward. Where do we go from here? Because we really are in the belly of the imperial beast. And so I think it's a question of organization more than anything else. You know, a lot of people may think or have the idea that they don't need to get involved with politics or political organization. I joined my first political organization when I was 15, which was the ANC, the African National Congress, in Britain. That's where the government in exile was. And as a 15-year-old, I couldn't understand why black people couldn't have a vote in their own country. It just kind of didn't make sense. So I started finding out more about it. I got involved. And then I joined CND, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament. And all of these things eventually made me realize that they're coming from the same source, the economic system, and so I became a socialist.
That was around the time of Greenham Common.
Greenham Common, yes.
Which, which was explain huge, what that is, a big U.S. military base in
so,
Britain.
Yes, Greenham Common in the early 80s was started by about 35 women from South Wales who went to Greenham Common in England, where they just started putting nuclear weapons in this U.S. base without... They could launch nuclear weapons from Britain without the consent of the British government. And so people were like, what the hell is this? It started with, you know, just like the sit-down strikes in Greensboro, North Carolina started with four people, the movement against Greenham Common base started with 35. One woman was killed during the occupation by a military truck that ran her over, Karen Davis. But it evolved within a few months into an occupation of 30,000 predominantly women, where they ringed the base and closed it down and shut it down so that they couldn't get trucks in or out, which sparked an international movement in Germany in particular to do the same thing. That occupation went on for 19 years, which is something, you know, worth kind of being inspired by. And interestingly enough, I was in Japan over December and January. And one of the meetings that I ran, that was run by predominantly women, showed the documentary of the occupation from Greenham Common. So the women, like a generation away, and half the other side of the world, were inspired by this message and taking heart from it as they went to campaign. So, you know, the working class, the people have a long memory.
You gave a little bit about your own biographical background and how you got involved. But what can do you have some concrete suggestions for people sitting here in this audience who are listening and watching the things they can do?
Yeah, it's not about buying green stuff. It's about getting involved in politics. And yes, that's right. It's the only thing we have. They have all the money. They have all the guns. But there's not very many of them. We are always more, many, many more. What we need to do is get organized and show our power, because we're the people who make all the stuff. And if we don't go to work, nothing happens. And so if you're not involved in some political organization, you should think about joining one, whatever is your particular issue. I was first involved in an anti-racist struggle that led me to an anti-nuclear power and nuclear weapons struggle that I kind of generalized from. And so whatever is your issue, I'd urge you to get involved and join an organization and think about what is connecting. I believe, as a socialist, it's the economic system that we need to get rid of, the whole thing. But, you know, if you don't find an organization around here in Santa Fe that you like, start your own. Get some of your friends involved. I think that that is the key thing, because ultimately, as far as I'm concerned, if we don't get rid of this system, and we haven't got much time left, but fortunately, as I said, we've got some inspiration from 2011 that is very, very exciting and points a way forward. But if we don't get rid of this system and implement something else, as I mentioned, based on cooperation, real democracy, and a long-term time horizon, then we face a very diminished future within many of our lifetimes. And I've been an activist, since I was 15, I guess, and I think it's the only life worth living.
As Shelley said, we are many, they are few.
Exactly, exactly.
So on that note, we thank you very much for coming this evening. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Chris Williams.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.